This episode is brought to you by Mountain Sea Media. I spent half my life near the Pacific Ocean and the other half in the mountains of Central Oregon. These places are full of profound stories and experiences that guide my life, even now as a media creator and a beer professional. This is how Mountain Sea Media was born. I realized how impactful stories are to our lives and business. Stories share good experiences and the warmth of friends. They improve business by sharing these experiences and connecting deeply with our customers. If you'd like to connect better with your customers through copywriting and storytelling, contact me at jeremy@mountainseamedia.com. It's your story. I'll help you tell it. Welcome to episode 44 of Good Beer Matters.
That sounds really cool. That's so amazing. I wish I could do that. And he kind of looked at me and was like, you can. Melbourne is kind of the hub for craft beer and beer education. Australia and New Zealand both, they really do have the US beat as far as full-flavored sessionable beers.
Once upon a time, US TV commercials told us that Australia had a single word for beer. Now things have changed, and the new word for beer down under is craft. I've never been to Australia or New Zealand. Honestly, craft beer is not the first thing I think of when it comes to down under. For me, it conjures images of the Great Barrier Reef, the Maori, the Aborigines, kangaroos, and men at work. I was lucky enough to discover an American expat and beer guide who has experienced beer culture here in the US, as well as having lived in New Zealand and Australia for the past 3 years. In this episode, she shares a story of travel, living abroad, brewing way down south, and how beer from both Australia and New Zealand are making really big waves for the global beer culture. My name is Jeremy. I'm a certified Cicerone, BJCP judge, IBD certified brewer, and a beer writer. I believe the art, the science, and the culture of beer has more of a profound effect on us than we realize. I believe there's a world of wisdom found in every glass, and I intend to get to the bottom of it. This is Good Beer Matters. These are the stories of us, of great food and the beer that brings it all together. I hope you enjoy episode 44 of Good Beer Matters with certified Cicerone, Lindsay Gregg.
Down under for 3 years, you said?
Yeah, 3 years I've been overseas.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about your history, your experience, and your role in the beer world, and then like tag on to your traveling throughout Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah. Cool. So I started working in beer about 5 years ago. I grew up in southern Missouri, but I was living in New Orleans at the time, and I was living there because they had huge tax credits for the film industry. I was an actor. I was pursuing acting. And as an actor in the States, most of us always work bar jobs.
Yes.
That's just synonymous with being an actor, is you're probably going to be a bartender at some point in your career. And I had always gravitated towards craft beer bars, not really thinking much of it. But living in New Orleans, I was managing a craft beer bar in the French Quarter. We had like 50 taps and it was all Louisiana craft focus, which at the time I think was a total of like 15 breweries in Louisiana. So I was working there and managing there and starting to get a little bit more into beer. I lived like two blocks from a nano brewery called Courtyard Brewery. And by a happy set of circumstances, or like a happy coincidence, I guess, the assistant brewer at Courtyard got injured with an accident with like hot wort, essentially.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah, it wasn't good. The bottom of it, because we just like wore, you know, everybody was in like tennis shoes and he was wearing soft tennis shoes and some wort had leaked out and kind of burnt the bottoms of his feet. So he was out of commission for a little while. And the owner, head brewer, was like, do you want to come work for me? And I didn't really know anything about brewing. And I kind of just said, yeah. So I quit my bar management job and just started working at Courtyard. So it's like, it was like a three barrel system, really, really tiny, making some really great beers though. He's very like California and like IPA focused. So I just kind of dove in head first, and I was doing everything from like helping with cleaning the little fermenters to like brewing, lots of cleaning, bartending. It was a small staff, so we all just kind of did everything there. So that was my first like kind of awakening, I guess, where I was like, ah, I could actually like just do beer stuff. Like this is something you can do for a job, and this is really great. And I fell in love with the community. And, like I said, Louisiana beer scene was really, really small at the time. So it was easy to kind of get to know everyone. And I did really feel like it was this amazing community where it was local producers supporting other local producers is what it really boiled down to. And then there was a Avenue Pub. If any beer drinker's ever been to New Orleans, they probably know Avenue Pub. It's one of the best beer bars in the country. I think it normally hits the ratings. It's a 24-hour craft beer pub in New Orleans. There was a bartender there, and it was during Mardi Gras, and he was moving to New Zealand to manage a craft beer bar in a small town in New Zealand that was on a beach. And I was just chatting to him, and I was like, that sounds really cool. That's so amazing. I wish I could do that. And he kind of looked at me and was like, you can, like, if you want to, you can. And then a few months went by, the person who he was working for in New Zealand actually came to New Orleans. I met up with him, and he offered me a job in New Zealand to manage a craft beer bar on a beach. Huh. And I had a few beers. I went home. I booked a one-way ticket to New Zealand. And that's how I ended up there.
Just like that. Yes, you can. It's that easy.
Yeah. And I, to be honest, like, I didn't even know where New Zealand was. I thought it was, going to be warm and tropical, like a beach bar. And then I got there and I realized, well, a little before I went, one of my friends was talking about New Zealand, and he was like, oh, a beach bar in New Zealand, like, that's really close to Antarctica. And I was like, is it? And I kind of Googled it, and I was like, oh shit, should probably know where I'm
what
going.
What have I done?
So ended up in New Zealand, what was originally just going to be a summer, helping manage a craft beer bar, which there aren't, it's talking about that, there's not a lot of independent, and I'll probably get into that later. There's not a lot of like craft venues in New Zealand. And even 3 years ago, like it was few and far between throughout the entire country. So to have a small town, a small like surfer town, have a bar that served independent beer was a really big deal. So I was able to kind of dive headfirst into the New Zealand beer community, which is a very, very tiny community. It's a really small country. And kind of get to know people through that. But yeah, it was supposed to be 4 months, and then I ended up staying with that company for a year and a half all up. And then I hopped on over to Australia, and yeah.
And just kind of kept the travel train going.
Yeah. Well, it was always, I was able to work in New Zealand under a working holiday visa, which a lot of people in the States don't even know about that. But if you're under 30, you can get a free working visa to New Zealand. That allows you to live and work there for a year. So it's completely free. You apply online, they grant it, and then you can go to New Zealand for a year and live and work. And it's a really common thing that a lot of people from like European countries and even South American countries like know about this program. I don't think a lot of Americans actually do, or that we know that it's available to us, because I moved to New Zealand at 28. Had I known that the working holiday visa was a thing, I think I probably would have gone there, you know, much younger. But I'm really lucky that I knew about that.
I was just saying, that's just a raging bummer that is just for young people. That's total ageism, because, you know, I would love to take my family and move somewhere cool like that. And And I had opportunities when I was young and like end of college and wanted to travel, but I didn't have the follow through, or I should say I had the follow through of a mid 20s year old boy. And, so needless to say, I didn't go. I figured, I'll do that later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think even when I booked the ticket, I had had quite a few beers. So it was kind of just like, I spent like $600 on a one-way ticket that wasn't refundable. So then when I woke up the next day, I was like, oh, I guess I'm doing this. Like, I'm going to leave. And I think I made that decision in May and then I left in October. So yeah, I had 5 months really prepare myself.
Well, I have a sneaky suspicion that beer was involved in a tremendous amount of both good and bad decisions. So I'm glad that worked out for you in a positive manner. But you know, I want to kind of detour real quick, just because I've had conversations with my brother-in-law talks about New Zealand all the time, and you know, just wanting to train. And he's an insatiable traveler. That he and his wife and kids have been all over the world. My nieces have been all over the world, and one is just starting college, and one is just starting high school, and they've been more places than I have, and a lot of people have. But they've talked about New Zealand quite a bit. From the standpoint of it's really hard to move there and become an expatriate from the standpoint of, they just don't want the average person to come and take their jobs. They actually have a list of jobs they actually need people for, you know, being like a doctor or maybe even a cop or something like that. And I wonder if brewing is on that list, just because if you get someone from the United States, or especially a hot spot like Denver, San Diego, Portland, or Delaware, something like that, as a brewer, and you know, show up to New Zealand, say, "Hey, you want to brew some world-class beer?"
Yeah, so that would be that's under skilled visas. Brewing is not on the list for Australia, but people who have a chemistry background or some sort of science background and some sort of work history that involves that can get like skill shortage visa, can actually come to Australia on the skill shortage visa, just on that, without having employment sponsorship. New Zealand is the same way. So when I first went over there, you could actually be sponsored to stay. If you had a background in like restaurant management, so you have to have so many years of provable work experience in a specific role, like a venue manager or like a general manager of a restaurant or a bar. And when I first moved over there, you could be sponsored under that. They don't need those roles filled anymore because tourism was booming and they didn't have people with enough experience to manage bars and restaurants. So there was a skill shortage at the time, along with chefs, I think actually can still be sponsored to work in New Zealand. There's a skill shortage for chefs there, or at least there was while I was still there. I don't know if that's because immigration things are constantly changing.
Sure.
There's always an update to immigration stuff, so while I was there, it was likely that I was going to stay, but the company I was working for and the company that I was being sponsored with, there was only so far I could go. There was like a woman above me and I didn't really have, like, she's never going to leave that role. She's amazing. She just has her place within the company. So there wasn't really room for me to grow. And that's why I came over to Australia, was because when I came over here, I could still get a working holiday visa because I just turned 30, and there was a likelihood of me being able to be sponsored by, like, at the time there was skill shortage for, once again, like venue management, hospitality management. So I thought there was a chance for me to be sponsored to stay in Australia. So that was one of the things that prompted my move over here. And I don't know if I should advertise it, but a lot of companies, they'll put your role as like a venue manager when you're actually doing another job, especially with breweries, because you can't be sponsored to be a brewer. they can sponsor you as, let's say, a chef, but then you're actually working as a brewer.
So they're just focusing on, they just want to check the box, make sure everything's legit. And then if they get audited, yep. they say, well, yeah, we hired this person for this, but we're small. We need him or her to help us over here as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of people got through, I think, on that. And a lot of like, I mean, there's heaps of expat brewers over here, like American brewers, in Australia and in New Zealand. But laws have changed recently where it's not as easy to get in. And with, to me, I think what's so frustrating with the Australian beer scene growing, they do really need, like a lot of breweries need people with brewing experience and need people with really strong resumes. But right now the Australian government isn't recognizing that as a need. And I spoke to a lot of, you know, brewery owners and just different people within the industry, and everybody's equally frustrated by it, that they can't sponsor, like a brewery can't sponsor a brewer to stay in Australia right now, which is really unfortunate.
Is one able to, like, for example, in Europe, and I don't know if I have my facts straight, but I remember hearing about this from a friend in the travel industry who's actually living in Spain and has been for the last 2.5 years. But he told me that when you go to Europe, you can only stay there for like 100 days. It's like the Schengen visa. And in order to get around that, then you have to leave Europe. Or in this case, I think they were even allowing people to go to England because they've got, you know, a foot out of the EU anyway. You had to just go stay there for like a weekend or a week or something and then be able to come back to Europe and start your 100 days all over again. Does Australia, New Zealand, do they have a similar type of thing where you just have to leave the country and head somewhere else for a bit and then come back and start over?
So you wouldn't be able to legally work unless you had a working visa. But as far as like if someone wants to visit Australia, I believe the visitor visa without working rights for Australia is like a year. Okay. New Zealand, it's only 3 months. So you can only visit New Zealand for 3 months at a time. I have a friend who just traveled around New Zealand for like 7 months, but he did have to go on visa runs, which is where you leave the country and go back in.
Okay. But that's just for the tourists, but for people who want to work there, that's a completely different process, you're saying, right?
Yeah, completely, completely different and not easy, not cheap either. Not cheap for, companies to sponsor, or not cheap for anyone who wants to move here and work. It's expensive and difficult. It's gotten more difficult in recent years, I think. Yeah. I mentioned that a little bit earlier, but 3, 4, 5 years ago, it was a lot easier to sponsor people. And now it's just, with governments everywhere, we're tightening down on immigration, I guess.
So for that person who wants to follow in your footsteps per se, it's just gotten harder now, and they're going to need some extra dollars in their pocket.
Yeah, or just be under 30.
Yeah.
if you're
I've been trying.
And, yeah, and I mean, and that even means 29. I mean, the working holiday visa, you have to apply for it. The one to New Zealand for Americans, you apply for it before you turn 30. So let's say if you apply for it at 29, you actually have a year to enter the country. And then once you've entered the country, you have a year to stay. But I like for Australia, I'm on a working holiday visa right now. So I was able to get it extended for a second year. And all I had to do was there's work limitations that I have on the current visa. One of them is that I cannot work for any company in Australia for more than 6 months, any one company. So every 6 months you have to change a job.
So you've been job hopping by necessity.
By necessity. And then another thing I had to do was to get my second year visa. I had to do hospitality or tourism work above the Tropic of Capricorn. which is just Northern Australia. It's like I live in Melbourne, so it's a completely different world up there. But I was really lucky, and because of the company I was working for in Melbourne and because of the connections that I've made, I was able to work for a brewery that had just opened up a new venue in Cairns, which is like one of the Great Barrier Reef access points. So I was able to work for a brewery and help train their staff and get them up and running, and then also develop their brewery tours. And I had to do that for 3 months to get my second year visa.
Interesting. Let's use that as a springboard to dive into the next topic. We alluded to beer education in Australia. So here you are, you are a certified Cicerone, are you not?
Yep.
And are you, you're also prepping for the advanced, correct?
Yes.
Have you set your test date yet?
So I was going to take it in November, in Chicago, but me and another girl, there's another American here. Her name's Becky, and she's certified, and she's also wanting to take her advanced, and we've had a little study group going. But it's so expensive for us coming from the Australian side, to try to correlate it with a trip that we have planned to the States anyways, and then the exchange rate's pretty not great. So I was going to take mine in November, but there's been other stuff like with my visa work, that I've been dealing with. So I'm pushing it back to next year. I don't know when next year, cause I need to set a good time to travel to the States. But I'm thinking I'm going to travel to the States like end of July and August. And if there's any exam date around there, that's what I'm going to latch it on to.
How funny. So I was going to test in Chicago in November, just a couple of weeks from now, from when we're talking. And it looked kind of like you, kind of life just kind of sometimes happens and priorities shift. And so I had to change that for next spring. So I've got a few extra months to cram all this ridiculous beer knowledge in my head. But so here you are, certified Cicerone, you're prepping for the advanced. So you are learning a ton about beer. Tell me about the level of beer, the general beer education in Australia and New Zealand.
it's gotten so much better in New Zealand as well. Like it's, there's not a lot of Cicerones in New Zealand. I haven't checked their stats, but when I first moved to New Zealand 3 years ago, I think there was only one certified Cicerone in all of New Zealand. In Australia, there's about 50 of us, and there's only one advanced in all of Australia. Melbourne is kind of the hub for craft beer and beer education. But the beer industry is so interesting here, just because, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that large breweries can still contract taps. So there's no three-tier distribution. So you have the large players, like one of the large players is Carlton and United. That would be like the Budweiser, over here. And actually they were part of AB InBev, but they just sold to Asahi. But you go to a lot of bars in Melbourne and they just have contracted taps with just the UB beers. It makes it hard for beer variety. And especially in the smaller towns where pretty much every bar just sells the same beers.
And so do these bars, you know, so this harkens back to the U.S. and pre-prohibition where we had tied houses where breweries basically, they didn't own the bar, but they owned the taps in the bar. So they may as well own the bar. That's just a quick aside for anyone listening. So that still happens in a lot of places outside the U.S. England, there's just a big thing about that in the last few decades, I think, was where they were trying to reform that. But is that to say that all the taps in one particular pub are owned by one particular brewery, or they're contracted where if they've got 10 taps, five of them are going to be the macros, and then they let the other five do what they want?
Yep. So it's a combination of the two. A lot of places that it went under contract years ago, you know, before there were even craft options, like they'll have all of their taps contracted and they're just known as a CUB bar. Like they are just a CUB bar. That's just what it is, bars and restaurants. Some places you go to will have 5, 6, 7 out of 10 contracted, but then they have like two that they won't contract, and they do contract to independent breweries as well. So it's not just for the bigger breweries, but small breweries can get contracts on taps. I know there was a bar in Melbourne that just opened and they have like, I think they have 10 taps, but 9 of them are on contracts with independent. They only have independent beer. But that means for any new brewery up and coming, you're on a waiting list to get on that one tap that they rotate between breweries.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So contracts are a thing. Contracts are a thing that breweries have to navigate. And it does make the craft market here quite competitive, and I think really difficult as well. But it, just for Australians, like, and especially when I was up in Cairns, there were only 4 venues in this town of 150,000 that sold craft beer at all, like independent beer. The rest of the venues were all contracted, like they're all from the major breweries. So this town is a major backpacking town, lots of bars in it, but all of them just have the same beers. So people who have maybe grown up in smaller town Australia, they don't really have the exposure to anything different than maybe what they've always had, which doesn't give a need for beer education, really. They just think of it as beer, like, oh, just a pint of beer, just a draft.
Yeah, like we did back in the 70s and 80s, where, oh, this tastes like beer. Well, what kind of beer? What do you mean, what kind of beer? It tastes like beer.
Yeah, but now, I mean, you are starting to see smaller breweries, like you're starting to see breweries pop up and small breweries pop up, and you're starting to see Australians get kind of like very excited about, oh, we have a brewery in our town now. But I think it's kind of just a time bomb that we're waiting for all of these contracts to just with the large, you know, the big breweries to kind of go away, to open more people up to like drinking things of a wider variety of flavors.
And so are you seeing that from the consumers as well? Well, they're just becoming a little bit more, less resistant, more intrigued, or?
Yes, absolutely.
Or is that just like a, like you said, like Melbourne is the craft hotspot. I mean, outside of that, I would imagine the big cities like Sydney would be more welcoming to a global type of culture. But what about some of these smaller towns? I mean, are there still people resisting it or kind of like open to it?
I think, and I just know my experience from Cairns, but I think it's kind of a mix of both. It is that, and I remember the States, you know, 10 years ago when in Louisiana or in, like, I grew up in Missouri, I lived in Houston, but like when craft beer was sort of like really starting to gain momentum, 2009, 2010, in the parts of the country that I was living, there were, of course, people that were really resilient to it, and just not wanting to taste any of that homebrew stuff. And I kind of see that here now, but it's the same thing where a lot of people, breweries that open up in smaller towns, start to get more of a loyal following. And I think as a whole, as a country, we're sort of kind of starting to shift towards local suppliers, and Australia and New Zealand especially is all about local, like supporting local, buying things made in Australia, like local produce, local food, especially in like far north Queensland, where they have so much amazing like fresh produce, but it's really buying from local farmers. Yeah, so I think that the craft brewery scene, people are starting to see that they want to support local, and that the beer can be just as good.
Go ahead and finish.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Well, I want to just be very clear, for especially from anyone from Australia or New Zealand who may listen to this, I don't want to lump those two countries and cultures into like the same basket. I do understand right. that they're very different cultures, very different countries. So are we seeing the same type of patterns in the world of beer in New Zealand as well?
Yeah, I mean, because it's such a small country, it does have an incredibly strong beer scene for being the size that it is. Like, there are heaps of breweries there. I mean, Garage Project is the most well-known, I think, and most internationally recognized. And New Zealanders are very, very proud of their local brews. The town I lived in for summers, the summer beach town I lived in, was Mongafai Heads, tiny, tiny, tiny place, mainly a batch town, which like holiday homes is batches. But just like 15, 20 minutes away from it is Waikū, and there's a brewery there called McLeod's, and McLeod's is absolutely incredible, and gets so much support from that community. And you know, there's 8 Wired as well, as all like in the north part of the North Island. And you see these breweries gaining a lot of speed, and they're not just doing normal beers. 8 Wired and McLeod's both have very strong barrel programs, and they put out sours, and they put out a lot of really interesting beers that aren't just your standard that you see. And once people, I think, like, the town I live, Mongafai, people would drink McLeod's beer because it was from Waipu. It was from the next town over, you know, they were going to drink that. They were going to support that very local business. And they start out by drinking the pale ale, and the next thing you know, they're drinking a sour, like an oyster goza, you know?
Oh, wow.
like, because they trust that brewery and they trust those beers, so they become more willing to try things. And I think that's how it is with Australia. They are completely different countries and completely different beer scenes, but as far as my view is always coming from living in the States, and I have always felt that Australia and New Zealand, the beer scenes when I first got over here, was a little bit behind the US. And I mean, everybody looks to the US, you know, for trends in the beer world. So it's been watching these two countries kind of develop, like kind of imitate. Of course, we've gotten on the New England IPA haze craze over here as well. Mm. But then now we're like, you see both countries kind of developing their own beer styles and beer scene. And I think people are becoming more proud of that, if that answers the question.
Well, no, absolutely. And I think for me, and I would imagine for you as well, being kind of like a scholar of beer, is I find that so fascinating, where right now people are watching what the U.S. is doing. And when we say the U.S., we're talking about some major hotspots like Portland, Denver, San Diego, Delaware, like we mentioned, among others. I don't want to disclude anyone, but I'm not going to name them all. But they're watching and saying, okay, this is what the U.S. is doing, and the U.S. is on fire right now. So let's kind of do what they're doing. But at some point, when they kind of learn how to do this stuff and they start getting some momentum and start hitting their stride, I'm just waiting for further sub-styles to come out. I've spoken to a number of people in Spain, and they have such an incredible and rich culinary tradition and a wine tradition that all these brewers, when they finally start brewing beer and really know how to finally realize, oh, hey, this is how to really brew some beer, we're going to start seeing some amazing things that I think will eventually surpass that of what we're doing here in the U.S.
Yeah, well, and it's really just about each country kind of coming up with what their strength is instead of just, and I mean, Australia has some really amazing breweries, but we have our own, like there's sub-styles here, like XPA, which I didn't know what an XPA was until I came to Australia. And then Pacific Pale Ale. Like that wasn't, I was like, what is a Pacific Pale Ale? So, you know, you see these things emerging, and granted, like I was so disappointed when I first got to New Zealand and I saw a lot of people using American hops because I was like, I'm in New Zealand. And all I really knew about New Zealand was like Nelson Sauvin and Motueka. And I was like, why aren't people just using the New Zealand hops? But at the time they were using a lot of like Cascade was such a major hop, and Centennial and Simcoe and all of the big American players. I was traveling around New Zealand and I was drinking a lot of American style IPAs, but now you're starting to see maybe American style IPAs, but made with more prominent New Zealand hops.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Bring totally different characteristics. And same with Australia. Like, I mean, Pacific Pale Ale is, to me, it's very much like an American wheat, but with a lot of galaxy. And it's a really great sessionable hot day beer, beach beer. It's such a good beach beer. Like Stone and Woods Pacific Pale Ale is, what I think of as like an Australian craft classic. But that is, you know, that is a style that's very unique to Australia. Like, yeah. Well, are there breweries making XPAs in the States right now?
I'm not aware of any XPAs, but I will, I will, you know, and I want to say somewhere in the ballpark of 2010, at least prior to that, and, you know, ballpark, I'm going to just ballpark it, but before, the Northwest was known for just the hops arms race. And this is verified with everyone I've talked to, including, you know, a professor of fermentation at OSU, who's like a globally renowned hop expert. He even talked about how the bitter hops arms race just kind of was kind of starting to get out of hand. And then along starts, you know, people are starting to mess around with some new world hops and that have more tropical flavors and have more nuance and more whatever. Next thing you know, I see, so I live in Oregon, and we see a beer kraut come out some years ago from a Good Life Brewing called Sweet As. And of course, Sweet As, you know, it's just kind of like a
Sweet As, bro.
common Australian phrase. And you look at the list and it's just like all Australian flavored hops, and it's just like this pale ale with all these tropical flavors and just like character reminiscent of almost like a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. Is just very tropical and kiwi and fruity and just bright and just delicious, and everything just shifted. And now everyone's got tropical hops, and now we've even got tropical hazy hops, and it's just, I mean, the whole IPA, the whole idea of hops shifted. And it seemed and I don't know this for a fact, but it seemed it kind of started with a discovery of hops from Australia, New Zealand, and a just completely different flavor profile.
Yeah, they're crazy here. And they are, like, I mean, New Zealand hops, New Zealand Plant and Food Research is an incredible facility in Nelson that has a lot of experimental varieties, but, you know, they're responsible for Nelson Sauvin and also Motueka and Raquel. Dr. Rudy, I think, is really interesting. But they're all those like crazy white grape, almost grassy, but not grassy in like a green, like a light grass. I always like a lime green grass. Super like mango punchy, but not bitter. They're just crazy interesting hops.
Oh yeah.
Melon, so many. There's great hops over here.
Well, and that's why in fact, when you and I first started communicating back and forth, I think I asked you, it's like, hey, who would be great to talk to in Australia? Because I want to get, you know, that perspective, you know, from that part of the world. And as you and I continued to communicate and I got to know a little bit more about your background, I was thinking, holy hell, I need to talk to her. And because you've been through New Zealand, you've been all through Australia, and you have that the ability to compare and contrast it with what the U.S. is doing, as well as having the education from Cicerone and advancing too. So that this just really worked out perfectly. But for those people who still think that Foster's is the Australian beer, I've heard from numerous people that Australians don't even drink Foster's. It's not even made in Australia.
No, so, it's not.
No, so put that gigantic ass can down, and tell me what is actually a good Australian beer that we might actually see here in the States.
Oh gosh, like independent or something that's.
Well, we probably wouldn't see an independent over here, not necessarily. You know, I can think of like Cooper's Sparkling Ale, for example, that we can find that, and we use that as an example of a very distinct English Commonwealth beer, aka an Australian sparkling ale. But
yeah, well, Cooper's is I've just recently Cooper's is like one of the only very very large independent brewery. Cooper's is incredible. Do you get Cooper's Pale Ale over there?
I believe so.
Or is it just Cooper's Sparkling? Because I think what's really interesting about Cooper's Pale Ale and Cooper's Pale Ale Fresh is that it's quite yeast-driven. It's quite farmhousey, which is really surprising if you're looking at, like, Carlton or VB Victoria Bitter. They're quite malt-driven beers as far as, like, the Budweiser of Australia would be, like, Carlton or VB.
Okay.
But they're very malt driven and kind of nondescript. Whereas Cooper's Pale Ale, you can find, like, if nine taps are contracted to one of the big players, then one tap might be contracted to Cooper's. So you can find it almost everywhere throughout Australia. They've done a really, really good job of that. But it is a very, like, it's actually a really, really nice beer. I think it kind of leans towards, like, almost a Saison, but everybody over here, just, it's an Australian pale ale. Like, that is the Australian pale ale.
And so I wonder if they're shipping a different version of that beer to us, because granted, we're going to get an older beer, and so we're going to see oxidation. We're going to see the hops fall off. We're going to see just kind of muted flavors. But I didn't taste anything that was overtly yeast driven, farmhousey, or even saison like. It was very
bland.
It was almost like an American blonde, but with a lot of character and a lot more like tropical flavor. And instead of like two volumes of CO2, is more like 3.5, maybe not quite 4, but probably 3.5. Is just super, super sparkly, and the carbonation was just very, very assertive. And just a heck of a palate cleanser. But you know, I can only imagine what it'd be like fresh. But I know that there are some companies that ship a completely different recipe to a different part of the world just based upon just palate demographics. So I wonder if that's the case here.
Well, I mean, the same thing with American beers coming over here, though, is a lot of times we'll get American beers and it'll be something that I'm super familiar with, and I'll go to have a pint and it's super oxidized and just hasn't been handled well. Australia is really far away. Mm-hmm. And as far as like my purchasing decisions in Australia, I do really try to mainly buy Australian and New Zealand beers, because it just takes so long for anything to get here from anywhere else.
Sure.
Well,
and on your
so
Instagram feed, I saw that you because you're always posting pictures of you with different beers. So life must be really good. But you did have a picture where you're holding up a Deschutes. I think it was a 29. Black Butte Porter 29. So that is a very big, strong beer they put out every year for their anniversary. So a beer like that, I would imagine, would make that trip and fare pretty well.
Yep, it did. It was, So there might have been some slight issues with it. It was a little more one note than I remember some of the past iterations of it being. There might have been a little bit of oxidation on it, but I was having that in Cairns in Queensland, and to get beers up there, I mean, there's not a lot of cold shipping that goes up there. But it was also, that beer, I think, cost me $60.
Oh my gosh.
Australian.
Well, I was just impressed
really
that you found that.
Here.
I'm impressed that you even found that. In fact, I was going to accuse you of having that shipped in.
Yeah, no. The brewery I worked for up in Cairns, we actually sold some decent things other than what was available at the brewery. And so I had purchased that from Hemingway's, from our little like takeaway shop from our cellar door or whatever. Cause it was my birthday, and
nice.
I thought it was a good birthday beer to have in a tub overlooking a sunset outside. That was great.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm male. How could I forget that little detail? Yes. You were in a tub and there's a tremendous view in the back and you had a beer. It's just kind of like, yeah, that could be a poster for a lot of different things, but I
embarrassed myself.
Well, I obviously I zeroed in on the beer. I was like, hey, Deschutes. And
yeah. Well, and that's another thing as well. Like when we get American beers over here, man, they're just so expensive. It's expensive to drink in Australia as is. Like pints of craft beer run from like $12 to $16 on average.
Is that, that's Australian?
Yeah, Australian.
What does that convert to in US dollars about?
Oh God. So right now I think it would be like 8 to 12 US.
Oh, so that's why you work in breweries, so you can get your beer for free.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. The truth. I will get to the truth.
It's expensive to drink alcohol over here. But I will say the great thing about the Australian beer scene is sessionable beers, and we also serve things in smaller sizes. So it's not just pints. You can almost always get a half pint of some sort that ranges from American 8 to 10 ounces.
Hmm.
So that's really nice, small beers.
I actually like that. I discovered that at a trip to Spain some years ago where they serve their tapas y cañas. It was just a 5 or 6 ounce beer. And you don't have it long enough for it to get too warm or just to sit and oxidize if you're sitting outside. I mean, you just enjoy that and have another one. Enjoy it. Kind of like getting a Kolsch in Cologne, Germany. I mean, they serve those in like 6 ounce stangs, and it's just, it's just that is just so nice. Heck with the mug club. Yeah. I want the Kanya club.
Well, and it's also just making things more, to me, it's more about sessionability. Like you're not just, well, I'm sort of dreading going back to the States because I know beers are such higher ABV, and I think I'm just going to be knocked on my ass.
Well, we are having a resurgence in session beers too. I mean, we are, that's been kind of a trend lately as well. So.
Yeah. But so we land in LA and I'm going to be drinking those West Coast IPAs. Well, they're fresh and I haven't had like a really just amazing fresh one, and I'm looking forward to going down to like Beechwood and visiting El Segundo, Monkish, of course. And I just like, I'm mentally preparing myself because we don't like beers in Australia and New Zealand. Sessionability is so important. Beers like average range from like 4.2 to 5.5%, and a lot of times when I know when like a customer comes to the bar and a beer is like 6%, they're like, Whoa, do you have anything? That's a little too strong for me right now.
Well, that's gotta be a kind of a holdover from the British, because it was kind of the same thing there where, I mean,
exactly.
The scandalous extra special bitter would like top out at 6.2 but that was for a top night,
funny.
How funny.
Yeah, and it does, and there's definitely that influence over here as well. You know, there's still, I mean, New Zealand was only found in the 1800s. So of course they still have like a very strong English influence, and Australia does too. Like, I think a lot of the drinking culture and alcohol laws even are still, I mean, they're part of the Commonwealth, but it's very, you can see the relation between the two.
Well, since we are getting on in time, before we start winding down, you got the rest of your day. I've got to go to bed soon, but, before we start our little wind down question process, what are some of the things that, how can I best phrase this question? I'm kind of asking a little bit of compare and contrast between the U.S. and Australia or New Zealand. What are some things that that they're doing down where you are that are just a little bit more interesting, a little bit more different than what U.S. is doing?
I think Australia and New Zealand both, they really do have the U.S. beat as far as full-flavored sessionable beers in all ranges, whether it be a barrel-aged sour or an IPA or, you know, like there are some great 3.2% sessionable IPAs here that are just, you know, they drink. You can't even tell they're low alcohol.
And they're not too dry.
And just today I've been sipping on an oatmeal stout with smoked malts and coffee that's 2.5%.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, really nice from the clouds over in New Zealand. So I think that's something that they definitely do really well. Because I haven't been to the States in 2 years, I'm not entirely sure 100% like what it's really like drinking over there. I can't wait to find out. But
it's changed
recently,
quite a bit
I just know
years.
That like, I'm sorry.
It's changed quite a bit in the last 2 years.
Yeah. I can't wait. but I know like, and especially where Melbourne right now, it's really like innovative and supportive, and the brewery I currently work at, Molly Rose, he's saison sour focused. He's doing some really interesting stuff, like a coffee citrus sour, and I think that there's a support system here that's really, really nice, and other breweries really support him, and we support other breweries, and it's very like comrade-y and friendly. And I see that in New Zealand as well. Like everyone's just friends. And I think that's really nice, especially when the markets are so competitive. But you go to something like, I just judged at the Independent Beer Awards, and like everybody's just such good mates with each other. Even though they have such a small share of the market, they're all just really in it together, which is just so nice to see.
That's kind of like it was not that long ago, and it's still pretty fairly amiable amongst the craft brewers to an extent. But you know, if we have not surpassed 8,000 breweries in the U.S., we're about to be there. So
yeah,
you know, the size of the pie is not growing. It's, you know, if anything, it's being diminished by spirits and wine, especially by hard seltzers and ciders. But
yeah.
But even though the pie isn't growing anymore, or maybe diminishing, there's more and more pieces of the pie coming in. So I think brewers in the U.S. are starting to get a little antsy. The ones that have been around for a while, who used to see double digit growth and would slap each high five each other every Monday through Friday, they're not doing that anymore. It's getting tight. Okay, so go ahead.
I do want to say that the hard seltzer thing has not come over here yet. So,
attention, all Australians and New Zealanders, resist it. Beer is better.
Resist. I'm hoping it doesn't.
I'm sorry. I am so biased, but I've tasted them. My wife likes them. I see the value in them. It's just a different tool for a different job, but to me, they are just so flavorless. And some are better than others, but I mean, I'm coming off of like a nice Session Blonde or a Cooper's Sparkling Ale or an ESB or something, or something that, is very thirst quenching. Oh, in summertime, give me the beer version of margaritas or a grown up Gatorade and just give me a Gosa and I'll drink that all day long. And I don't want a sparkling ale. If I'm going to drink, I'm going to drink.
You mean a hard seltzer?
Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Like a La Croix with alcohol.
Yeah. Oh, right? Did I say cider? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry. I've got Mad Leper cideries, but the hard seltzers, I'm just not there. I'm not there yet.
Yeah.
I'll have a gin and soda or before I have one of those. Same thing, I guess. So let's begin this wind down series. So I'm going to take my magic mash paddle and wave it over your head, and you get to be a queen of the beer world for a day. What are you going to change?
You are not allowed to serve amazing independent craft beer at your venue unless you've passed a very strict exam about beer service and line cleaning and beer clean glassware. Like, you do not get the right unless you pass an exam.
Excellent.
Just because I see a lot of, there's just a lack of education about, in Australia, everywhere really, just about what a clean glass is. What clean lines are. Like, so many times I'll go to bars I'm not familiar with and order a beer that I'm very familiar with, and it comes out just horrible and undrinkable. And it's not the beer, it's the lines and the points of service. So that, if I was queen for a day, I would make people pass an exam before they are allowed to take the care of craft beer into their hands.
Nice. I love that. In fact, it was that experience that that kind of spurred our beloved Cicerone founder, Ray Daniels, into, as the story that he tells, just having a very well-known beer that he's had hundreds of times. And he has it, and it was just horrible. I said, God, this is terrible. Someone ought to do something about this. And as he tells the story, all eyes just looked at him, and next thing you know, he's doing something about it. And here you and I are studying like mad about beer, all thanks to him.
Yeah. yeah.
So I know you've listened to this podcast before, so I know you know what's coming next, but, I'm sure you thought about this. If you had the ability to choose your very last meal and your very last beer, what would they be?
Yep. So I have been thinking about this. and because I grew up in Missouri, Boulevard Wheat is just, ooh. I cannot wait to get back to Missouri and have a Boulevard Wheat with, dare I say, a lemon slice in it, which is kind of sacrilege, but that's just how we drink it in Missouri, a pint of Boulevard Wheat. It is so refreshing and flavorful and has that citrusy note and a very full mouthfeel and a little bit of a spice thing to it. I can't wait to have that beer. So I would love, like, that would be my last beer, just a big old pint. With a lemon slice, and I'm just really homesick, but a really solid plate of nachos.
Oh my gosh. That is probably one. That's one of my favorite, last meal answers as well. It's nachos, just good nachos.
Yes. Mm. Nachos, but it has to be good nachos, man. Like, I want fresh jalapenos. Don't give me any of those pickled things. Oh.
Not ballgame nachos.
No, I want like just a big mound of nachos with my Boulevard Wheat, and I will die the happiest person.
I love it. It's funny. I grew up where we drink Mexican lagers with lime in it, and And, you know, of course, lime is there to hide sins and make it nice and bright and acidic on a hot day in the Southern California. But there's a flavor and experience component there, too, that's just magic. So, I am definitely not going to judge you throwing some citrus in your beer.
Yeah, I judge myself. I've listened to a lot of podcasts with, I can't think of his name right now, but the head brewer at Boulevard, and, you know, he, like, putting a lemon in it became such, like, a Missouri thing, and he's not against it, but kind of would like to persuade you not to do that, but that's just what we do, and it does have a very specific, it just does something.
Yeah.
It's very nostalgic, you know?
The very first wheat beers I ever had in the beginning of the whole craft microbrew movement in SoCal back in the, that I remember paying attention to it in the 90s was, you know, all wheat beers were served with either lemon, maybe an orange. I thought that's just how it was supposed to be. And now it's I kind of like it, but I get grumpy when I'm not given the choice. It's like, no, let me decide. But still, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, so with all of your experiences, particularly in the Southern Hemisphere, and just kind of seeing the U.S. and, you know, just seeing different cultures and understanding different cultures and everything, you know, in your estimation, why does good beer matter?
Good beer matters because it brings an awareness to the present moment. It's more than just sloshing down a pint, you know, it's more than just crushing something. It really is taking a breath and recognizing what you're drinking and where it's coming from and the flavors, like everything you're experiencing. It really is a mindfulness thing. And, bringing us all, like, even if it's after a hard day at work, you sit down, you have a pint of beer, and you just breathe, and you're brought to the present moment, and nothing else, like, the rest of the day doesn't really matter. You're just enjoying what's in front of you and really experiencing it. Yeah, it's like yoga of the beverage world. That's why good beer matters.
I love that, too. I agree with everything you've been saying. So, I'm going to throw you for a curve, because, as you've mentioned to me that you've listened to this podcast, so I'm going to ask you a question I've never asked anyone else before.
Great.
do you have a favorite episode?
Ooh. Actually, so the one that was about, draft lines.
Draft lines. Okay. Yeah. That was, with Master Cicerone Neil Whitty.
Yeah.
Formerly of Boulevard Brewing.
Yep. That's who it was. I loved that episode though, because the entire time I learned a lot from it. But it's also just like someone's out there really fighting the good fight, like preach. draft system maintenance. It's so, I can't believe how much of a, like, an afterthought it kind of is, still. And, you know, I love going into a place that's like, oh, we clean our lines every week. We clean our lines between beers. Like, that's, I love hearing that. That's, you're just like, oh shit, you care. Like, that's so good. So I loved that episode. I have recommended it to many friends.
Thank you. I think the thing I loved about that, here's a guy who is a master Cicerone. He was like number four or five, I think it was, if I remember right. And, you know, like a lot of people who are really into beer, they're going to take the food pairing, or the brewing or the ingredients or something that's just, you know, in the beer world, really, really sexy. And he took, in my estimation, what I imagine, like, just a broad audience would assume is like the least sexy thing of beer. It's just nasty, dirty, moldy, disgusting draft lines. And that's what he decided to become the expert on. And I just commend him for saying, okay, someone needs to do this. I got it.
Yeah.
So, So if anyone wants to connect with you, especially if they're down under and they're like, oh my gosh, I gotta learn from this gal. How could they reach out and connect with you if they desired to?
Easiest way is probably through my Instagram, which is at talkbeardy to me. And that's beardy, BEERDY to me, TOME. That's probably the easiest way. You can also through the Cicerone website. I've actually had some people contact me through there as well in the directory. So that's always useful. And I always forget about that tool when I'm trying to get in contact with someone that I can like go on the, if they're a Cicerone, I can just go on the Cicerone website and reach out to them.
Yeah. I admit,
I always forget about that.
I forget about that too, but I'll link your profile into this as well, so people can connect one way or the other.
Cool.
So thanks. Lindsay, any last words of wisdom?
I think just to anyone who's even thinking, or, you know, if hopefully I've maybe inspired some young little beer guns to get out there. If they're interested in moving to New Zealand or Australia, like, just do it. Like, it's so good to live in different beer cultures and experience different things. And I think it's really important to step outside your comfort zone. Just do it.
Right on.
Thank
you.
That's all I got.
Thank you so much for coming onto this podcast and kind of talking to me about Australia, New Zealand, the beer cultures down there. And that was just a huge mystery to me. And I'm glad it took us like several weeks to kind of figure out this whole schedule, or for me to figure out the schedule. I'm glad it worked out. Thank you for taking the middle of your day off just to talk to me about beer.
Yeah, of course. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Talk to you later.
Cheers.
Exploring the world by traveling or living abroad is an incredible way to understand other cultures, as well as developing a deeper appreciation of our own. Finding a beer expert like Lindsay to guide us through the food and beer of the region just makes the journey that much sweeter. Join us in the next episode where we head back to Hawaii, where one brewery is making an indelible mark on the environment and beer culture. Good Beer Matters is a show about great beer, great friends, and the experiences we create together. But it's also about better appreciation of the beer you enjoy. I believe better education leads to better enjoyment. So if you're a beer and food professional or even a beer enthusiast, then please subscribe to Good Beer Matters and visit me at goodbeermatters.net. After that, grab a beer, hang out with friends, and let the world open up. Thank you for listening. Cheers.